nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Enjoy the show.
Okay, so this is ECE-495N, Fundamentals of Nanoelectronics. And I guess this semester they're planning to tape the lectures. I think in the past they have done this once, and it's posted, some of those old lectures are posted on the web, we can give you a website. But this semester the plan was to retape the lectures actually. So, but please don't let that affect anything in this class. We are supposed to just go on normally as if nothing else is happening, and feel free to ask questions as you need. And okay. Okay, so now this course, I guess the name is Nanoelectronics, and now nano, of course, these days is a buzzword, it's a very common word that you have, I'm sure you have heard this before. Now, one question, like, is it clear what nano comes from? What does it stand for? Is it nanoseconds or nanometers or nano?
10 to the minus
10 to the power?
Minus
9th, actually, yeah, right. 10 to the minus 9th, and it's not nanoseconds, because nanoseconds, people have been doing experiments on that scale for a very long time, so that wouldn't be anything new. It's more the nanometers, that's on the length scale. Nanometers meaning is 10 to the minus 9, that's a billionth of a meter. In fact, let me quickly write down a few length scales here, so we're clear. Like what? One scale we are all familiar with is a millimeter. I mean, that's like a physical, you know, something we can all kind of point to about that much, like a millimeter. Now, if you go down a factor of 1,000, that would be 1 micrometer. So this is 10 to the minus 3 meters. If you went down a full factor of 1,000, it would be like a micrometer. Or sometimes people call it a micron. So you say 1 micron, that's a micrometer. And you go down another factor of 1,000, that would make it a nanometer. And atomic distances, like the distance between two atoms in common solids, is more on the scale of like a tenth of this. Like people say the distance is about 2 or 3 angstroms. And an angstrom is like a tenth of a nanometer. So a nanometer, usually you'd have about 3 or 4 atoms in a nanometer, see? Now, what has happened over the last 40 years or so is people have gradually learned how to make devices smaller and smaller. And the reason computers today are so much more powerful than, say, 20 years ago or 30 years ago is that they can pack a lot more transistors, a lot more of these electronic devices into a single chip, into one of these computers. So the commercial computers that you buy today has about 1 billion transistors in it. And that number just keeps increasing. Every new generation has some more, actually. And the way this happens, you could do just a simple piece of algebra to see. So supposing you have a chip that's like 1 centimeter by 1 centimeter. And we ask the question that how many electronic devices could you fit into this? So it depends on, of course, how much space each one takes. Now let's say each one takes, say, 10 micrometers. Then, so how many could you fit this way? In one direction. If each device takes about, say, 10 micrometers, how many do you fit? Remember, a centimeter is really like 10 millimeters, right? So if you have 10 millimeters and each one takes up 10 micrometers, how many do you fit? 1,000. So you'd fit about 1,000 this way, another 1,000 this way, which means you'd have about 1 million in there, which is about where things were 20 years ago. Now, these days, of course, you can fit a lot more. So let's say each transistor takes up not 10 micrometers, but 1 micrometer, 1 micron. Then how many could you fit in this direction? 10,000. So that would be 10 to the fourth, and another fourth this way. And now you have got about 100 million. Now, today's number, like the commercial transistors, commercial in your laptops that you buy, that's like a billion, which is about 10 times bigger than that. That's because the chip isn't really 1 centimeter by 1 centimeter. It's actually somewhat bigger anyway. So, but that's roughly where we are these days. You can fit a transistor like within a micron or less. Micron. Okay. And a transistor usually consists of something like this, that you have some active region material, which you call the channel, across which you have two contacts, which you usually call the source and the drain. And when you put a voltage across it, you have a current that flows in this circuit. So you have electrons that come from the negative terminal and go through this and come back into the positive terminal. So if you're looking at electrons, that's how it would be flowing. The direction of current, unfortunately, is just the opposite of that because electrons have a negative charge. So if you're drawing the current, you draw it this way. And if you look at this voltage and divide it by the current, you call that the resistance. And the inverse of that is what you call the conductance. And a transistor is basically a resistor whose resistance can be controlled. Controlled with a third terminal. Third terminal meaning usually what you have is something here, so a voltage that you apply across an insulator. So here is a channel, this active region where the current flows, but then on top of this you have an insulator and you put a voltage on this, and this voltage controls the resistance. Now that's the important thing is, ideally, no current really flows here because of this insulator, no current flows. And yet, it actually controls how much flows this way. So by putting a voltage on that, you can change this resistance. And in a typical field effect transistor, like it goes from this off state to the on state. And the resistance changes by a few orders of magnitude. So in the on state, it might be say 10 kilo ohms. The off state, it would be like 100 megohms. Right? So by putting a voltage on this, and these days the voltage involved is about 1 volt. So if you put 1 volt here, what used to be 10 kilo ohms becomes like 100 megohms. And you call that a switch. And basically, every computer has like a billion of these switches acting in concert. And all the wonderful things it does is because people can design this whole array of switches to do all kinds of useful things. Okay. Now, the general thumb rule is that this channel region, you know, this active region that I call, let's call the length of this, say, L. That's the length of this region. Now, the space that this entire transistor takes is about 10 times the length of that channel. Now, the way I've drawn it, it doesn't look like 10 times. But the thing is, usually these contacts are big things. So if I really drew this to scale, I should have drawn a very big thing like this out here. Because the contact is usually a big thing where other things are connected to it and so on. So usually the thumb rule is that if this whole thing takes up a micron, then that length is about a tenth of that. See? So today's commercial transistors, if you looked at the length of that channel, okay, that would be about, and I argued that the transistor takes up about a micrometer, so the length of the channel is about a tenth of that, say 0.1 micrometer. Actually, I think these days the latest ones may be half of that. So that's some other way. Okay. Now, how many atoms would that be? Well, you see, you know, 1 nanometer has about 3 or 4 atoms in it. And we are talking about, say, 100 times that. So we are talking of, say, 300-400 atoms. So that's the length of, like, one of these channels in a transistor. It's 300 or 400 atoms. Okay? Now, as I said, it wasn't always this way. Like, 20 years ago, we were talking of dimensions up here, when it was really many thousands of atoms long. But now it has come to this. See? And so there has been a lot of progress, actually, in terms of our understanding of how current flows on this atomic scale of things. And that's what really this course is about. See? Giving a view of how people think about current flow on this scale, because that's kind of what is needed if you're going to design devices on this scale. I mean, not just transistors, but all kinds of devices, sensors, energy conversion devices, all of this. And in this course, though, we don't really go into any specific device in any detail. And the reason is that a lot of these devices are really evolving. The ideas, concepts are really evolving. And if we talked about a particular device, the chances are it wouldn't be very useful to you. In the sense that by the time you graduate and actually get into, you know, get into jobs and all that, those ideas would have changed. There's no particular device that's really you need to know a lot about necessarily. It's not clear 20 years from now, 10 years from now, what kind of devices would be used most or would be the most useful in terms of various applications. But what you really need, though, is more just the conceptual framework of how to think about current on this scale, how people think about, you know, designing devices on this scale. And that really is very different from the way people think about devices on this scale. That is, many of you, I'm sure, have taken 305. Okay. Just for my information, how many of you have taken 305? Okay, that's about half of you or more. Okay. Now, 305 is really about how to think of devices on this scale of things. No? And as I say, that's where kind of our understanding started from. Because 20 years ago, that's all we had. And people, in fact, often, it was an interesting question that people would ask. Now, what would be the resistance of something that's like a few atoms long? And no one quite knew the answer 20 years ago. And it was a very interesting question to talk about. It was a fun thing to talk about, actually. No one knew the answers. And what's happened in the last 20 years is the answers have become clear. In fact, as I said, all the useful devices are now on that scale, really. That's what you're talking about today. And it will get smaller. Okay. And one point I'd like to make is that actually the way you should think about devices on this scale actually is very different from what you learn in 305. So although, you know, if you have taken 305, it's very useful. Useful in the sense it's good background, but it's not really essential. See, which is why I think in this course we list 305 as a core requisite that it'd be good if you have taken it and if you have seen that material, because then you can kind of connect and compare and all that. But it's not like I'll be building on concepts from there, and so if you have not taken 305, you're at a big disadvantage. It's not that way at all. Okay. And in general, we sometimes use this word, you know, they call this top-down, and what you might call a bottom-up view. Now, you'll often hear these words, but usually you hear it in the context of how people fabricate devices. That is, you see, usually when you make a transistor, the way commercial transistors are made in your laptop, these chips are made, that process you'd call a top-down process. Top-down in the sense you take a piece of silicon that's big, and then you etch out what you want. So you start from something big and you etch it out. And one of the things that now people have been looking at in this whole nano area is whether there's a way to build things from the bottom up, where you actually take atoms and molecules and get them to come together in a certain way and get to something useful. So that's what people call the bottom-up way of fabrication. But as I said, most of all the useful things that are built today is still really top-down. Okay. But here I'm using those words more in terms of not how you fabricate things, but more like how you think about things. That is, that when we think about what resistance means, The way we currently think about it is what I'd call top-down. That is, what you learn somewhere in high school is that this conductance here is related to something called conductivity. And usually what you say is that the conductance is proportional to the area of the resistance, the cross-sectional area. So if you have a, if your current is flowing this way and you have a big area, you'll have a lot more current. And so it's proportional to the area. And it's inversely proportional to the length. And so this is the quantity that you call the conductivity. So that's something you've probably seen in somewhere in high school. You call that Ohm's law, conductance inversely proportional to the length. So. And then you say, well, what does the conductance depend on? Well, it's supposed to depend on the electron density, N, and the expression people write down often, NQ square tau divided by M. You've probably seen something like this if you have taken 3 or 5. If not, as I say, it doesn't matter. I mean, it's not like this is what we'll be talking about. It's more like I'm just telling you for reference that usually the way people think of big conductors is that the conductivity depends on electron density. Then this is what they call the mean free time. And this is the mass of the electron. And this Q, that's the charge on an electron. So let me write this down somewhere. Maybe I'll just write it here. So this Q is the charge of an electron, and that is 1.6 times 10 to the minus 19th coulombs. Coulomb is the MKS unit of charge. Right? So we are generally using MKS units, except for one thing which I'll mention in a minute. But the MKS unit of charge is this coulomb. And the charge on an electron is a very small fraction of a coulomb. This 10 to the minus 19th times 1.6. Okay. Now, what's this mean free time? Well, there the idea is that you see, when you have a device on this scale, the way an electron gets from left to right, you see, when current flows, of course, there's this electron that comes in from here, gets in here, and then gets through this device, and then comes out here. And the point is that in big devices, the way an electron gets from here to here is not just a straight path, but it's more like comes in, gets scattered in some direction, you know, hits something else, goes off in some other direction, hits something, maybe goes this way, and maybe goes that way. So something like this. So the typical path of an electron getting from left to right would be something like this. And you call this diffusive motion, or random walk through this thing. And there's a general tendency to go from left to right, but it kind of is like this. And so mean free time is the length, is the average time it moves in a particular direction before it gets scattered. So that's what this one is. Okay. Now, that's a good description of devices where the channel length is somewhere here. Now you see, when the channel length is somewhere here, then you see the picture of how electrons go from left to right doesn't really look like this. It really looks more like, let me draw it here. So when you're getting from left to right, it's really more like this. See, goes straight. Why? Because, you know, the mean free time is long enough for it to get from left to right. Within that time, it's gone. So that's what you call ballistic transport. The idea being it goes like a bullet. That's it. So it's ballistic transport. And that's what things are like in most of today's devices. You're almost there. Maybe one or two scattering, but that's about it. So when you get to that scale, it's not quite clear then, if you had to use a formula like this, what you'd put for the tau, for the mean free time, because that seems irrelevant. It just goes right through. Actually, I made a slight mistake here. What I meant to write here is not G, but the conductivity. You see? This is what's called the conductivity. So the expression I've written here, that really is for conductivity. And that is usually viewed as a material property, something that depends on the material of the channel. And then there's this geometric factor. Same material, you make it bigger, the conductance is bigger, and so on. Anyway, so that's the conductivity, really, not G. Okay. So one of the first problems you have in this top-down viewpoint, because most of the time what happens is, this is what you have learned in 305 and elsewhere. This is how you think about things. And so when you get down to small things, you try to use this viewpoint and project it down to small things. And then it looks very complicated. That's the point I'm trying to make. It looks very complicated because you don't quite know what tau to use. You don't quite know what mass to use either, actually. And the reason is that, you see, the mass of an electron, of a free electron, that is, an electron in vacuum, the mass is 9.1 times 10 to the minus 31 kilograms. That's the mass of an electron in vacuum. Now, in a solid, though, that's not the number you're supposed to use. And the reason is that, you know, solids are complicated objects. And one of the things that people learned back in the 30s and 40s, it was a very important discovery, that when you're trying to talk about an electron in a very clean, perfect crystalline solid, it behaves almost as if it was moving in vacuum, but with a slightly different mass. Not necessarily slightly different. I mean, different materials, it's different by different amounts. So in gallium arsenide, for example, the mass that you're supposed to use, this is called the effective mass, is actually about 7% of that. So quite small. In silicon, you'd say about 20% of that. Okay? So what mass you use kind of depends on the material and so on. But then when you get to small things, it's not clear where what to use, really, because, you know, you have this small thing which is, and this whole idea of mass comes from a periodic solid. That the idea that you have a crystalline periodic solid and then you have things called band structure which tell you what mass to use. Well, if you have a device which is about 10 atoms, then it's really not very clear you can use masses that apply to big periodic solids, you see, etc. So, as I said, this isn't clear, that isn't clear. Actually, this isn't very clear either, the electron density. You might say, well, you surely know how many electrons you have in the thing. But the thing is, you see, when you talk about the conductance of something, how much current flows, it's really not, doesn't really depend on how many electrons you have there. You know, even the best insulators have zillions of electrons in it. It's really not the lack of electrons. But the fact is that, so that N is really the density of what you call free electrons. So the idea is that somehow, of all the electrons in your solid, some are free to move and some are not. And the question is which ones are and which ones are not, etc. So that's not at all clear again. So the point I'm trying to make with all this is that the usual way you learn this, while this works quite well for big devices, if you really try to project it down here, it doesn't get you very far. It looks very confusing. On the other hand, what we'll be doing in this course is a different point of view, which you could call a bottom-up viewpoint, where we actually start from this end. We start with something really small, and what I claim is, you know, that you'll see is relatively simple. That's like what we'll be doing the first week. We'll be talking about really small things. If something's really small, what is its conductance? See? And then if you project it upwards, you see a much cleaner, you see quite clearly what to expect. You see? That's what I'll be doing. Okay. And so from this bottom-up point of view, I'd say the basic formula, and this is what I'll be trying to discuss in the next, like in a little bit today and the next day, is the following. It looks like this. G is equal to Q squared over H. And this H is the Planck's constant, So let me write that down. That's another fundamental constant that will come up often. So that's Planck's constant H. And every once in a while, we'll write H bar, you know, H with a thing running like this, which is actually H divided by 2 pi. So it's just that often instead of H, what comes up in your equations is this H over 2 pi. So people have a different symbol for it. See, write that. Okay. So conductance is equal to Q square over H times, we'll put down, pi d gamma. And what I'll try to explain, in fact, today itself what I'll try to explain, that when you have something really small, then the maximum conductance you get is this quantity Q square over H, which is this fundamental constant, actually, because Q is the charge on an electron, H is Planck's constant. And I'll work out in a minute how much that comes to. The dimensions of this is the same as the dimensions of conductance. And this is something that, you see, 20 years ago wasn't known at all. You see, the reason we have a top-down viewpoint everywhere is, as I say, 20 years ago, no one quite knew what happens at this end. As I said, it was a good after-dinner discussion, like, you know, what would happen if you had something really small? No one knew the answers. This is kind of, no one. Whereas now, what's clear is, when you have something really small, and you make good contacts across it, the conductance you'd get is this, Q square over H. And then this factor I'll explain. This D is what you call the density of states. And this gamma is, again, has the dimensions of energy. It's related to how easily electrons can come in and out of the contacts. So you see, for current to flow, what has to happen is an electron has to come in here, and there have to be some states in here so it can come in. And that's the density of states. And then it has to be able to come in and get out. And this coming in and getting out is the gamma. D is the states. So it depends on the product of those things. And in something really small, what happens is this quantity is about 1. And so the conductance you get is, maximum you get is Q squared over H. So this viewpoint then gives you a pretty clear picture of how conductance evolves from small things to big things. And that's what I'll try to get across in the rest of this lecture today and tomorrow and the next lecture. You know. And what we'll have is a quantitative relation that you could use to calculate the current versus voltage of any small conductor, essentially. Okay. Or any large conductor also, for that matter. Okay. So, with that then, let me try to explain why the conductance of something really small is like Q squared over H. Okay. So let me write this. So write this equation here so we have this. Now, the way you think about current flow through any material, first thing you do is say that, well, in this active region, what are the energy levels for electrons? So what I mean by that is, I guess, as you know, like you have studied the hydrogen atom, for example, somewhere along in your, probably in your first year or second year, you have seen that. And you know, hydrogen atom, there are energy levels like this that electrons can occupy. Now the point is, even in any material, not just a hydrogen atom, bigger, any bigger atoms, molecules, solids, in any material, there is always a whole set of energy levels, see, that electrons can occupy. And some of these are filled and some of these are empty. And usually, as you might expect, the electrons go in and fill up the lowest ones. And the upper ones are usually empty. And the way it goes in is, there's this exclusion principle, which tells you that into each level, you can only have one electron. So if this material, let's say I've drawn four levels here, and in this material, if I had, say, three electrons, they'll probably go in here, here, and there. And then if you had 4, it would go in there, let's say. Now, to that, I should add this one small thing, and that is that usually all these levels come in pairs. That is, they usually come in 2 at a time. And we call one of them this upspin level, and the other is the downspin level. And later in this course, we'll talk more about spin in depth. But at this time, the main thing is they always come in pairs. And each one of them can hold one electron. So the right way to draw it would be, I draw 2 lines here and say there's one there. So for example, if I had 4 levels, and of course each one comes in pairs, so there's really 8 levels, then it would hold 8 electrons. Now often what people do is rather than draw 2 lines, they draw 1 and then say, well, let's just put 2 electrons there. They say, well, you know, you got 2 electrons in there. Which isn't quite right, because the exclusion principle says that each level can hold only 1. It's just that there's 2 of them. It's really 2 levels, each of which holds 1. But then it's a little easier to draw it by saying, well, I got 1 level, but then it holds 2. So often people do that. Okay. So the point here, though, is that there's a whole set of levels that are full, filled with electrons, and there's a set that are empty. Now, how do you know where these levels are? Well, experimentally, the way you know it is through the photoelectric effect. What that means is that, you see, you have all these electrons inside your solid. If you hit it with light, then you can knock electrons out of the solid. And what you look at is what photon energy you need to knock electrons out. So when an electron comes out, you see, inside this nucleus, there's this positive charge which holds the electrons there. And if you hit it hard enough with a big enough h nu, it will come out. And then you can detect these electrons coming out. See? So this is what people call the vacuum level. Vacuum level means it's like the electron inside a solid has like a negative energy that stays there, that keeps it there. And this negative only because it's this relative thing that matters. And usually people think of this as the zero, that if it can come out outside, that's what you'd call zero. And anything less than that is what keeps it inside. So if it's down here and you hit it with light, whose h nu happens to be that much, then you'll be able to knock an electron out. And any h nu less than that wouldn't knock any electrons out. So what you're doing is you're hitting it with light, keep increasing the frequency or decreasing the wavelength, and see at what point you actually get electrons to come out of the solid. And that then tells you where this level is. And then you keep increasing h nu some more, and then you find that again, when you hit this one, you suddenly find there's an increase in the amount of electrons coming out, because now these guys can come out too. And then there's these, etc. And so that's how you figure out where all these levels are. You see, people do these experiments. These are called photoemission experiments. Now, the reason it actually takes special facilities to do these experiments, and the reason is that this h nu typically isn't like visible light, because with visible light, h nu would be approximately 2 or 3 electron volts. With visible light, 2 to 3, or maybe 4 electron volts. Whereas in typical solids, this needs to be about 7 or 8 electron volts. So what that means is it's not visible. It's like more into ultraviolet and X-rays. It's got a much bigger h nu, and so you need special sources for that kind of light. It's not something you have easily, often. But that's the kind of thing people use to, you know, measure these things, the photoemission experiments. Now, that usually wouldn't give you much information about the empty states. Why is that? Well, there's no electrons there to knock out, basically. So the way you usually find these out, sometimes you do it by absorption experiments. Absorption meaning, if you hit it with light with this frequency, with the h nu corresponding to that, then what you do is take some of these electrons from here and put it up there. And that then would show up as an absorption. That when you shine light, ordinarily the light goes right through, but then if you happen to hit this one exactly, it'll absorb a lot of light. So the fact that there's an absorption kind of tells you there must be an empty spot somewhere in there. So that's how you usually figure out the empty ones. And then there are other more sophisticated experiments also for how to find lights. And the point is, in the course of the 20th century, what people have done is they've studied a very wide variety of materials so that there is a good understanding of these levels, of where the empty ones are and where the filled ones are. You see, this whole thing of quantum mechanics, it started about 100 years ago when people had a lot of information about the hydrogen atom, you know, where these levels are, and they were trying to figure out a conceptual framework within which they could understand where those levels are, you know, where those levels come from. And that's how it culminated in Schrodinger writing down his famous equation based on which they could understand all the levels in a hydrogen atom. And gradually what has happened in the course of the 20th century is people have figured out how to put in more and more complicated effects into that Schrodinger equation so that you can treat more complicated things, you know, not just hydrogen atom. Hydrogen atom is like the simplest thing, of course. It's got one positive charge, one negative charge, the simplest thing imaginable. After that, it gets more and more complicated, and gradually people have figured out, you know, how to use the Schrodinger equation, but more sophisticated versions of it to basically model all kinds of complicated things, you know, like silicon and gallium arsenide and all that. And all that has been complemented with experiments, because in this business, it's like whatever you calculate is usually approximate. You've thrown out a few things, etc. And you constantly have to check against experiment to make sure, I mean, like a reality check, then to make sure that what you're doing has some connection with reality, that it really allows you to model what you see in the real world. See? So what's happened then is people kind of have a very good idea of these levels of all kinds of materials. Okay. Now, these then are the levels that correspond to this channel, the part in the middle. And then you have the two contacts on the two ends. Now, contacts also have levels, except that usually because these contacts are big things, the levels are almost continuous. Because one of the principles that's not quite obvious, but we'll discuss this, is that as you make something bigger, usually the levels get closer together. So, in general, when you have a hydrogen atom, the levels might be, say, 10 volts apart. But then if you had a bigger molecule, the levels might get like a 1 volt apart. And then you make it bigger, they might get a millivolt apart. And in the big solids, often they'll be like fraction of a millivolt apart, etc. So in these contacts, usually, you have lots of levels. So it's almost like it's continuous. Okay, and so it's, and if I had to draw all of them, you know, I'd be just drawing lines forever. So instead, people just say, well, you have a continuous set of states, and you ask, well, what's the density of states? You know, how many do you have per unit energy range, for example? Okay. But here also, the guiding principle, though, is that there is still a line that separates the filled ones from the empty ones. There's some here that are filled and some here that are empty, and they're separated by a line that you call the electrochemical potential, mu. So that is what separates the filled ones from the empty ones. Okay. And I guess you have two contacts on two sides. So this is like your channel. This is like your source, one contact. This is like your drain. And overall, there is a chemical potential that separates all the filled ones from the empty ones. Okay. Now, what determines whether this thing conducts or not? Well, the basic principle is this, that this will conduct if you happen to have lots of states around the chemical potential. So you see, that expression I wrote down, this pi d gamma, that d here, I said is like density of states. But it's not the density of states anywhere, but what is important is the density of states you have right around the electrochemical potential. You may have a lot of states down here, but they won't help you conduct ordinarily. You might have a lot of states up there, that's not important. What's important is how many states you have there. So you see, the way I've drawn this, you know, I drew some states up here and some states down here and nothing around here. So the way it stands, this won't conduct very well. Okay, now how could you make it conduct? Well, that's where the gate comes in. Because what the gate does is, it changes the potential in this region, and so it makes the states in here move up or down. So if you put a positive voltage, for example, on that thing. What it does is locally it takes all of this and pushes it down. Now that's a tricky point though. You see, positive voltage always pushes things down, negative voltage raises it up. The reason being that, you know, these are electron energies. So if it's positive, it makes it easier for electrons to get in there. That's like pushing the levels down. Whereas if it's negative, it means electrons want to avoid it. That's like pushing it up, so electrons don't get in there. So if I put a positive voltage on here, all these levels will come down. And then these states here will, instead of being up here, could be right around the chemical potential. And then it would conduct. Or if you put a negative voltage, then you could be raising all this up. And then these states down here would be around the chemical potential. And then also it could conduct. So there's two ways to make this thing conduct. You know, one you call N-type conduction, the other you call P-type conduction. There's two ways of making it conduct, positive or negative. But the point is, you can control the conduction through this essentially by moving these levels up and down. That's the basic principle. Okay, so next you could say, well, how do I write down the current through something like this then? And now, the first point to remember, as I said, is that you have, that all that matters is what levels you have around here. So let's, for this discussion, assume that we have a conductor, this channel, where there's only one level of interest around here, somewhere around here. Just one level. I mean, of course, any material, there'll be lots of other levels, but we assume that those are kind of outside the picture. So they don't matter because they're not around the chemical potential. Okay. Now, when you apply a voltage across something like this, so the way I've drawn this then, it won't conduct because there are no states here. No states. Okay. Now, how will it conduct? Well, if you put a voltage across this, so I put, let's say, a negative on this side and a positive on that side. Now, what the negative does is it takes all the states in this contact and pushes them up. Again, remember, negative pushes up, positive pushes it down. So the negative on this pushes it up, the positive on this kind of pulls it down. And so the picture then, once I've applied this voltage V, looks something like this. This gets pushed up somewhere here. So I'll call it mu 1, because now I have two different chemical potentials in the two contacts, because everything here has got pushed down relative to this, changed. And this has gone to, say, mu 2. And of course, the two are separated by this applied voltage, Q times V. Because I've applied a voltage here, V. Now, why is it Q times V? Well, because these are energies. You see, V is potential. And potential times energy, that's potential times the charge is like energy. So these are, see, Q is the charge on one electron. So when an electron moves through a potential V, the amount of energy involved it, Q times V. So these electron energies are separated by Q times V. Now what I claim is, if you had a situation like this, where this level actually lies between the two chemical potentials in the two contacts, that's when current will start flowing. Why is that? Well, the physical reason is simple. Its idea is something like this. You see, this contact likes to fill up everything up to here. So when it sees a level there, it would really like to keep it filled. You see, when two things are in equilibrium, they both have the same chemical potential. You want to be filled up to the same point. It's kind of like the level of water. That if you had water up to some point here and you connect it to something, it wants to fill it up to that level. So anything below this, it would like to fill it up. So it would like to have an electron in there. On the other hand, you see, that contact, its chemical potential is here. So it would really like to keep it empty, because this state is above mu. So it would really like to bring it into equilibrium with itself and make it empty. So every time this is empty, an electron comes in from here and fills it up. And then this one, of course, sees it's full, and it doesn't really like it, and so it pulls it out. You see? And then this extra electron in here, of course, goes out into the battery, and a new one comes in from there. And this just goes on. And that's why current flows. And you have this? Yes. Yes, please. Right. So the point I'm trying to make is that whenever the current will flow, when you have a level in this window between the two chemical potentials. Because the first point is that when I apply a voltage, I no longer have one chemical potential, but I have two. Because the two contacts have kind of got shifted with respect to each other. That's what this voltage did. And now, under these conditions, you have a situation where this contact likes to fill up that level because the level is below the chemical potential. And this contact likes to empty it because it's above the chemical potential. And so what happens is this contact keeps filling it up and that contact keeps pulling it out. And this just goes on forever. And so electrons keep going from left to right. That's it. And then you can see why levels down here don't matter. Why? Well, you see, these levels are down here. They are below both chemical potentials. Okay, so this level, this contact would like to fill it up. So it fills it up, puts an electron in there. And then this contact would also like to fill it up because it's below the chemical potential, you see. So this says, well, there's an electron there, that's great. So everything's fine. That's it. So no current flows. It just stays full. That's it. End of story. And same with levels up here. It's like this level wants to keep it empty, that level wants to keep it empty, it just stays empty. That's it. So only time current flows is when you have a level in a situation like this, where the two contacts have two different agendas. One would like to fill it up, one would like to empty it, and then it keeps flowing. That's the essence of it, you see? So that's why you see, in order to have current flow, what you need is a level within this window. So if you were to draw the current versus voltage for a small device having just one level in it, the way it would look is something like this. That before you apply a voltage, let's say your mu was somewhere here. So you had a single chemical potential all the way across your device and no currents flowing. But then as you put a voltage, you pull this down and you push this up. And at first, no current flows because there is nothing within this window. But then at some point, you cross that level. And that's when current will start flowing because now you actually have a level within that window. So if you actually looked at current versus voltage, it would look like something like this. That as you put on a voltage, at first nothing, no current would flow. But then once this chemical potential crosses this, that's when current will start flowing. And in the opposite direction also, similar story. Because in the opposite direction, what you're doing is instead of going like this, you go like this. But again, same story. Once one of the mu's crosses that level, that's when current will start flowing. And so you expect something like this. Yes, please.
So in such a case, shouldn't this be like a unit step? Why are we having a unit step?
Right. So ideally, here, one could draw, like what he says, step like this, right? Now, in practice, what you'd see is some rounding to this. And what I'll do next day is we'll actually talk about what this rounding is should be. Because, you see, what I said earlier is that the conductance of something really small is Q squared over H. Right? That's what I say. Now, conductance, as you know, is like dI dV. And if it really stepped up like this, then dI dV at that voltage would be infinite. You know, because that slope is infinite. It's really stepping up right away. And what I'll try to show you next day is that actually there is an upper limit to how fast it can step up. So that it cannot really do this. There has to be some minimal rounding to it, such that the maximum slope you could possibly get is this quantum of conductance Q squared over H. Okay? So that's what we'll do next day. So let me stop here today.